Thank you, Neil. Thanks.
I'm not prepared. I'm not prepared at all to introduce the speaker. But this is Alberto Nicolis. Many of you know him from his work in cosmology and effective field theory. And we're very delighted to welcome him here and hope his interest in theater will grow and grow.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here as usual. So today I'm not going to talk about my work in cosmology. I'm going to talk about some more recent work I've been doing the past couple of years about hydrodynamics and in general about applying field theory techniques to condensed matter systems. And over the years I've accreted a number of collaborators here, as you see, many names probably you recognize. And we published a number of works. Of course, we have a number of papers. Of course, I'm not going to be able to talk about all of them. In fact, I will mostly focus on the work in progress, which is what I'm more excited about right now. So, first of all, what's my motivation to entertain such a program? Well, the motivation is that fluids are literally everywhere. So we are literally surrounded by fluids. See, the atmosphere is a fluid. Oceans are fluids. And in the lab, we can come up with much more exotic fluids, like superfluids, for instance. And in space, by which I mean in astrophysical systems and in cosmology, we are also always, most of the times, dealing with fluids, okay, both traditional ordinary fluids and sometimes superfluids, for instance, in neutron stars. And so hydrodynamics is a very universal phenomenon in nature. And I think that, of course, I mean, over the centuries, hydrodynamics has made incredible progress, but it's still a very difficult problem. So many, many problems are unsolved. And I think we can benefit, at least for some problems, by using a field theoretical approach. Okay? The reason being that, first of all, fluids are continuous systems, and field theory is about the dynamics of continuous systems. And on the other hand, field theory has been studied to death for particle physics. So there's a number of incredibly powerful techniques, computational techniques, and also theorems about the behavior of general field theories. And we can see whether we can export some of those techniques to this very universal behavior of natural systems. And by the way, usually one say, OK, but why do you care? Hydrodynamics is mostly classical, unless you deal with superfluids. So why bother? Well, field theory, if I use all the field theory technology and I truncate at three levels, can still be a powerful tool to understand classical systems in perturbation theory, for instance. Okay? So you don't need to have large quantum effects to benefit from using field theory. So let me sketch very briefly what hydrodynamics is about. Hydrodynamics is a certain behavior of certain physical systems, let's say close to thermal equilibrium. Okay, so suppose you have a gas of weakly interacting particles. So microscopically, these particles are nearly free. But if you go above a certain scale, the so-called mean free path, you cannot neglect interactions anymore. Okay, because the mean free path is the distance, the average distance you have to travel between one collision and the next. And once,
I'm sorry, just on the previous point, why study classical systems? Isn't it even more than that? Isn't it that quantum theory does provide a cutoff? It solves the ultraviolet catastrophe in a fluid?
Yes, you're saying fundamentally, yes.
Fundamentally, so
that's
quantum
right.
Theory is a really nice way.
That's true, but let's say in an ordinary fluid like water at room temperature, before worrying about quantum effects, you have to worry about thermal effects. So in a sense, you don't
thermal
see...
Classical effects do have an ultraviolet catastrophe.
That's right, but I guess what I'm saying
is...
You treat
the fluid as a continuous classical medium, it doesn't really make sense.
Yes, that's true, but I guess what I'm saying is that to actually compute realistic quantum effects in ordinary fluids, you have to work very hard. So I'm not sure that you can really use quantum field theory.
I don't mean to calculate anything,
efficiently,
just to regularize it. Quantum theory is a good regularizer of classical theory.
Before you get to that, you encounter another cutoff, which is the mean free path. Okay, so the mean free path is really the cutoff, the ultraviolet cutoff of the low energy effective description that goes under the name of hydrodynamics. So in a sense, it's different from, let's say, the ultraviolet catastrophe you could have for a gas of photons, in which you don't need these, I mean, you can really extrapolate the theory of photons up to arbitrarily high energies. Whereas here, you cannot extrapolate aerodynamics to arbitrarily high frequencies or momenta. You first encounter another cutoff.
In nature, you do.
But in nature.
Regularizer.
In nature,
you
yes.
You could consider a quantum theory of occludence, which is
yes.
Regularized system without even...
Yes, so we tried, and there's a number of subtleties. So I'm happy to discuss them offline because it's a complicated story. But yeah, in principle, you're right. So, okay, so what's the deal with the mean free path? So the mean free path is this typical distance above which you cannot neglect interactions anymore. And in fact, the system starts behaving very differently. So you start seeing collective excitations rather than microscopic motion. And these collective excitations in ordinary fluids are like sound waves and vortices, for instance, generic vortex configurations. And if you work at frequencies below the mean free time, which is the analogous time to that concept of mean free path, and at distances above the mean free, sorry, at timescales above the mean free time, at the distances above the mean free path, you can work with an effective description which involves macroscopic quantities, like conserved quantities, the stress energy tensor and the current. I'm using a relativistic notation just for simplicity, but everything I say applies also to non-relativistic fluids. And hydrodynamics is defined as the theory of these conservation laws, okay? Supplemented by what the experts call the constitutive relations, which are just expressions that relate to the conserved quantities. This could be, for instance, the current of particle number, of baryon number, or I don't know, if you're doing superfluid liquid helium atom number. And supplemented by relations that relate the conserved quantities to more basic quantities, like the velocity field, the density, the pressure, etc. And importantly, derivatives of these quantities. The reason being that, like all low energy, long distance effective descriptions, hydrodynamics is organized in a derivative expansion. So it's organized in a perturbation theory measured by derivatives, okay? Derivatives multiplying these critical scales we were talking about, L and tau, mean free path and mean free time. Now, it's because it's only an approximate description, and so when you want to be more and more precise and you want to start looking in perturbation theory at what happens inside the blob, okay, you have to pay the price of powers of the ratio of these two scales, okay? That's the standard thing about effective long-distance descriptions. And the problematic thing about this standard description of hydrodynamics is that the derivative expansion is highly non-trivial, meaning you don't just write down everything that is allowed by the symmetries, okay? You have to impose by hand, order by order in this perturbation theory, that you obey the second law of thermodynamics. So this is standard. You open Landau and Lifshitz, and you look at relativistic dissipative fluids, and there's a very non-trivial way of implementing the second law of thermodynamics at first order, even in derivatives. It's totally non-trivial. Takes Landau to do it. And you do it, but then when you want to go, let's say, one more order in perturbation theory, it's even less trivial. So it's really demanding to implement these constraints that comes from thermodynamics in a systematic way, okay? And on the other hand, in particle physics, we have a very similar picture. In fact, I took the same picture, but I just changed what's inside the blob. And it's the picture of effective field theories, in which suppose you have a complicated theory like UCD, okay, which is strongly coupled, and you don't know how to solve. But for some reasons, typically symmetry reasons, you know that there are light excitations, like the pions in QCD, which you can interpret as Goldstone fields or pseudo-Goldstone fields. Pseudo-Goldstone bosons. And regardless of what goes on inside the pion, okay, as long as you work at distances bigger than the compositeness scale of these excitations, these low energy excitations, you can build an effective field theory that describes just the low energy excitations without worrying about the details of the complicated microscopic physics, okay? Organized in the following way. You introduce fields, let's call them phi, that describe the infrared degrees of freedom. Figure out the symmetries that act on them. Typically, they are nonlinear. That's why I'm writing here a generic functional, because for Goldstone fields, symmetries, the interesting symmetries are nonlinearly realized. And then you write down the Lagrangian as a generic function of the fields, and the effective Lagrangian as a generic function of the fields and their derivatives. Once again, organized in a derivative expansion, like before. But now the difference is that this is totally systematic, meaning that you literally write down everything that is allowed by the symmetries. Okay? And so the idea is, can we do the same for hydrodynamics? Can we come up with an action principle for hydrodynamics in which the derivative expansion is systematic? Okay? And there's a number of byproducts that are welcome, at least from my viewpoint, which stem from the fact that you have an action rather than just equations of motion. So usually hydrodynamics is defined at the level of equations of motion, but now you have an action if you manage to do it. Which is a more economical, yet more complete description. It's more economical because it's just one functional for all the fields rather than n equations for n fields. And it's more complete because it contains the equations of motion. If you include the variational principle, but of course it contains more information. For instance, it contains a natural definition of energy and in general conservation laws that follow from symmetries, okay? Which at the level of the equations of motion are more difficult to figure out, the conservation laws, whereas at the level of the Lagrangian, they follow from the symmetries. And once you have an action, you can also straightforwardly couple your system to other systems, okay? So like, say, gravity, the electromagnetic field, etc. Whereas if you think about how you'd couple system A and system B at the level of the equations of motion, it's not obvious at all how to write consistent couplings in one equation and the other equation in order to conserve, let's say, the total energy. Okay? We know how to do it only very simple systems. Very simple cases. And in practice, we know how to do it if we are able to relate those equations of motion to a Lagrangian. Okay? Whereas in the Lagrangian, it's obvious. You just write terms, Lagrangian terms that involve both sectors. It allows canonical quantization, which you can use either to do what you were proposing, or for realistic situations to describe a superfluid, for instance, in which you know the quantum effects are important.
Sorry, and can I ask about that previous point? I mean, we do know how to couple a fluid to electromagnetism and
yes.
to gravity.
Yes.
So what's the
suppose I ask you now, okay, how do you couple two fluids? Do you know how to do it?
Well, it depends how they interact.
Well, that's the point. But what are the allowed interactions based on generic principles like conservation of energy, etc., conservation of momentum? It's not easy to figure it out. So, for instance, suppose you know that a finite temperature superfluid can be described according to this two-fluid model as a zero-temperature superfluid interacting with a normal fluid. Now, if you follow the Landau derivation of how to write down the couplings, it's a mess. Whereas in this formalism, you write down the most general Lagrangian involving both sectors compatible with the symmetries.
Okay.
So I'm not saying it's impossible. I'm just saying that at the Lagrangian, we know exactly what to do. At the level of equations of motion, you really have to be inventive to figure out what are the constraints you have to impose between this term you write here and the other term you write in the other equations of motion.
Okay.
See what I mean?
But I mean, the complication is with these inventive terms. The perfect fluid terms are usually straightforward. You said writing hard derivative terms is a thing that you have to be careful about. And those are the dissipative terms that are not counted.
For a single fluid, I'm saying, when you try to couple the fluid to something else, for instance, in this two-fluid model of Landau, you have a superfluid and the fluid, they are compenetrating, they exchange mass, they exchange energy, they exchange particle number, they exchange everything they can exchange.
So
writing down the equations of motion is a mess.
Even at the lowest order.
Lowest order in perturbation. Yeah. Lowest, without dissipative effects.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Yeah, I'm not saying it's impossible. I'm just saying this is much more systematic. So if you manage to do it, it's a simplification.
Just comment on the downside.
Yes. Very good. Sorry. Yes. So the apparent downside is that there's no room for dissipation because once you have an action, you cannot write dissipative terms. Now, I want to be able to tell you the details about how we manage or how we sort of manage to take care of this. But we are essentially extending a technique introduced by, I guess it's fairly standard in certain communities, but this for the high energy community, the first time I've seen it is in this paper by Rothstein and Goldberger about dissipative effects in the emission of gravitational waves by binary systems. Okay, what they are able to do is they are able to characterize dissipative effects as couplings between your low energy degrees of freedom and they call them composite operators. So let's say couplings with another sector, which is responsible for dissipation. In their case, it's the degrees of freedom of a black hole. In our case, it would be the microscopic degrees of freedom of the fluid that you're not taking into account. And the question is, Instead of thinking of dissipation as a loss of energy, think of dissipation as an interaction. So this is our action, which is known for the Gaussian fields. This is another sector, okay, which you are not keeping track of because you are lazy or because it's too complicated to keep track of. And then there is an interaction, okay? So dissipation, so you have dissipation here simply because you are not taking into account this, okay? And so if you are able to take into account this in a model-independent fashion, meaning if you are able to write down couplings of this system to this other system based on symmetry principles, okay, and the derivative expansion, you have a chance of being able to model apparently dissipative effects here in a model-independent fashion. So we've been able to do this at linear order in perturbations. We are still confused about how to extend it to nonlinear order. But essentially the idea is, in nature there's no dissipation. What looks like dissipation is an exchange of energy with something you're not keeping track of. Try to model that in a model-independent fashion, which sounds like an oxymoron, but at some level it's possible. I'm happy to discuss the details, but they're not in the talk, so we can discuss them offline. Okay? Yes?
Maybe it's semantics, but I don't like the way you advocate the action approach is the more systematic. I think writing down equations of motion is no less systematic. It's the same effect if you feel the velocity as doing this with the action. So it might be easier for some technical reasons, but from a point of view of writing down all operators compatible with symmetry, I don't see why doing this in Lagrangian is more systematic.
Well, because then, do you agree that order by order in the derivative expansion in hydrodynamics, you have to impose by hand the second law of thermodynamics? And that's kind of painful?
Well,
technically painful.
Well, it might be painful, but this is just the condition on the efficiency of the expansion.
Well, but it tells you that only certain structures can appear, those that in the divergence of the entropy current give you perfect squares, so that you can ensure that the divergence of the current is increasing.
Yes. All I'm saying is that it's a technical difficulty rather than systematic.
Okay, yeah, maybe I shouldn't say systematic. I'm saying it's technically easier.
It's important because systematic means that you have the approach in which, in principle, you can write down everything which is admissible. Mm-hmm. Right? Non-systematic is that you are doing this ad hoc, and that's not the case.
Isn't there an advantage that an action is invariant, whereas the equations of motion are covariant? Isn't that an advantage in writing an action down? It's simple.
It might be if
transformation rule is simple.
If it is possible to write down the action which takes care of this effects to all others, which is not. I'm not criticizing. I'm just saying that.
I think we agree. Technically, we just okay.
It's not as strong as you.
I think you're right. I mean, I'm just advocating this viewpoint because I like it better. But by I agree with you. I mean, of course, hydrodynamics is. I mean, so there's incredible progress has been made in hydrodynamics applying this technique. So of course, people who do hydrodynamics know what they're doing. So okay. So our approach has been to try to construct these effective field theories for fluids and superfluids. And so to be agnostic about the microscopic degrees of freedom and to just focus on low energy, long distance degrees of freedom and symmetries and to organize the theory in the usual way of effective field theories. So the first step is to understand what the degrees of freedom are, okay? So usually you'd say, okay, they are rho, p, u mu, etc. But these, from our viewpoint, are derived quantities, okay? And the fact that these are the most physically interesting quantities for standard hydrodynamics doesn't mean that they are the fundamental degrees of freedom, okay? So it's like saying, suppose you have a point particle without a potential. You're saying, well, I really don't, since I don't have a potential, I don't care about the position, I care about the velocity, okay? Which is the analog of saying, u mu is your fundamental field. But of course, if you try to write the action just in terms of the velocity, you don't get a very nice variational principle. You get v equals zero here, okay? Unless you impose some constraint or Lagrange multiplier, unless you do a constrained variational problem. So we know what works best in mechanics is to use the position as a fundamental degree of freedom, even though maybe you're just interested in the velocity. So for fluids, you can do the same. Use the positions rather than the velocity field, okay? So you have a medium, and at this level, there's no difference between another continuous medium, like let's say a solid in the continuum limit, so forget about the lattice, and a fluid. So you have a medium, and you characterize its configuration space just by specifying the positions of volume elements in real space. So you attach a comoving label. We call them phi I, phi 1, phi 2, phi 3. So you attach a comoving label to each volume element, and you follow that volume element in space as a function of time. Okay, so this would be the analog of bosonic string in which you do xm as a function of sigma and tau. So here it would be x, physical x, as a function of phi and t. Phi is comoving variable. Now, we find it more convenient to invert that mapping at a given time and use phi as a function of x and t. It's equivalent. But perhaps it's less intuitive physically, but technically it's more convenient, at least for relativistic fluids, for relativistic theories, because now x and t are just x mu, and phi are just scalar fields. So you have now a theory of three scalar fields rather than a theory of coordinates x that under Poincaré mixes with t and, okay. I guess what I'm saying is that the space-time symmetries in that description are less obvious than in this description. Yes?
So should I think of x as the position at time t and phi I of x and t is the position that original x moved to after time t passed?
Yeah, you're saying if you start at t equals 0 with phi equal x, then yes.
Right, so whenever I've seen you talk about this before, and I felt surprised that this could work, just because it seems like there's a sort of
ambiguity.
There's a memory of where the thing started at some arbitrary time. How could that possibly be relevant for anything? And of course, that plays no role, but I'm just surprised that you can get away with that.
Well, let me move by half a slide to this slide. Okay, so there's an ambiguity in what we mean by these comoving coordinates, because for a generic fluid state, I mean, these comoving coordinates, we can pick them arbitrarily curved. Okay, but probably a good choice is then when you bring the fluid to equilibrium at rest, okay, you want your comoving coordinates to be aligned with the physical coordinates. It's just a choice. It's just a choice of the how to parameterize the configuration space. So it's identical to saying, if you have a particle on a line, you want to parameterize its position with x, but you can also parameterize its position with a generic q, which is a generic function of x. It's a choice. Once you make that choice, you are done.
Is that just like coloring the fluid?
It's coloring the fluid. You're sprinkling tracers in the fluid.
You're going to have a coloring symmetry that the whole theory has under recoloring.
Very good, yes, but, okay, let me get to that. But I guess what I want to disentangle a physical symmetry that I'm going to introduce in a second, which is analogous to this coloring symmetry, with some sort of gauge redundancy that you have in any Lagrangian system. You have to tell in advance what is the definition of your Lagrangian coordinates. And that's not a symmetry of the action, okay? So if I chose completely screwed up coordinates here, I would get a completely different action, completely different looking action, okay? So clever choice of coordinates like this one allow you to characterize the symmetries of the action much more efficiently. But you're always free to choose whatever Lagrangian coordinates you want. So this is an unphysical symmetry. But in a second, there will be a coloring symmetry, which is physical now. Yes?
I'm confused here. Is that any different than the earlier description versus the Lagrangian description?
It's the same.
OK, so oh.
It's the same.
So you should use this word so that.
Yes, yeah, yeah, sorry, I should have used these words. Yeah. Yeah, right.
The initial position, or you need to, so you're in the Lagrangian
position. Yeah, sorry, so these are Eulerian coordinates and these are Lagrangian coordinates. So I'm using Lagrangian coordinates as functions.
You kind of reverse Lagrangian because the variables are the Lagrangian coordinates. So usually when people talk about Lagrangian
space,
you say velocity as a function of original position.
It depends if you're in the Eulerian or Lagrangian picture.
You're right. So I'm using Lagrangian variables as functions of Eulerian variables.
Okay, yes, good.
Okay,
good.
Now the reason I don't use that language automatically is that when I pronounce Lagrangian, I think of the Lagrangian functional that goes in the action, so it gets mixed up. You see what I mean?
So,
No, you're right, but that's the psychological reason why I don't use it. Why I don't use it immediately? Okay, but anyway, so with this choice of coordinates, we have an apparent paradox, okay? Because formally, from the viewpoint of field theory, we have scalar fields whose expectation value at equilibrium breaks breaks spatial symmetries like translations and rotations. It also breaks boosts, But boosts, you do want to break, because a fluid or any medium picks a reference frame. Okay, so boosts, you want to break spontaneously, but you don't want to break translations and rotations. A fluid should look homogeneous and isotropic. So the only way to make up for that in this language is to come up with internal symmetries, internal shifts, and internal rotations that act only on the fields and not on the coordinates, so that that expectation value, phi equal x, is invariant under diagonal subgroups. So you're mixing now, the state mixes space-time and internal symmetries. Okay? And this way, you recover the physical homogeneity and isotropy. What do I mean by physical? I mean that your favorite quantities like rho, p, u, mu, etc., will have those symmetries. Okay? They will be homogeneous and isotropic. It's only your position degrees of freedom that don't have those symmetries, but that's natural, because if you keep track of positions, of course you're going to break translations. Now, all that I've said, by the way, this formalism has been rediscovered over the years many times, most recently by us and by Jakeven collaborators, okay? But and here we come to your coloring symmetry. So far what I've said applies equally well to a generic isotropic system, even let's say a solid without a lattice structure, a solid which is some sort of random arrangement of atoms. Like, I don't know, wood, for instance. But what differentiates a fluid from a solid is the invariance, and this is now a physical symmetry, under volume preserving diffs, meaning the following. At least if you start from this equilibrium state, you want a fluid to be insensitive to physically moving things around, okay? As long as you don't compress them or dilate them, the fluid should be insensitive to volume preserving adiabatically slow motions, okay? Whereas if you take a solid, if you try to move physically things around without compressing or dilating, you're still feeling a lot of very strong transverse stresses that want to bring the volume elements back to the rest position. So mathematically, this is implemented as a volume preserving symmetry acting on your coloring variables, okay, phi I. And this is a huge group. It's an infinite dimensional group, okay? Now you can, I won't have time to show that it's an infinite dimensional global symmetry which has infinitely many conserved charges, okay? And you can arrange those conservation laws to give you Kelvin's theorem. Kelvin's theorem it's an incredible powerful statement in non-dissipative hydrodynamics, which tells you that if you take any loop and you follow it through the fluid, sorry, and you follow it as it moves with the fluid, so this is really a co-moving loop if you want, the line integral of the velocity field is conserved around the loop. So it's some sort of conservation of vorticity statement. And you see, it's infinitely many conservation laws because the loop is arbitrary, okay? So it's not a standard conservation law in which you have to integrate a density over all the volume. Here you integrate some quantity over an arbitrary loop. So you have infinitely many independent conservation laws. And in this language, they follow from this symmetry. So this is a very physical symmetry, okay? It has infinitely many physical consequences, if you want. Infinitely.
What did you call this symmetry?
Volume preserving diffs and Kelvin's theorem. Kelvin's theorem. Yeah. Yeah. In fact, this way you can prove a relativistic generalization of Kelvin's theorem, which we did prove, and I think it was unknown in the literature.
Counter as a version of it.
Excuse me?
Random counter.
At the ver. Yeah, but I. Do you understand that version?
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
Eric
yeah.
Borgelon is. Recently put out a detailed review of that.
Okay, maybe I should read the review because the original paper I didn't understand really,
yeah.
Even the formalism. Okay.
Yeah, it's a bit ugly.
Yeah, okay.
It's heavy.
But it's very, yeah, very geometrical.
Yeah.
It has a nice
book. Okay, so I'll read the review. Anyway, so if you buy my logic so far, or even if you don't buy it, you can just try to. Okay, construct the most general effective action compatible with the symmetries and check whether it reproduces hydrodynamics. So shift invariance on the fields tells you that you should focus on derivatives of the fields, the lowest order in derivatives, just first derivatives. And then Lorentz invariance tells you that you should contract derivatives. And then you're left with this matrix in IJ space, d mu phi I, d mu phi j. And then this volume preserving diffs tells you that the only object that you want to consider is the determinant of that matrix, because the determinant changes by the determinant of Jacobians, but volume preserving diffs have the unit Jacobian, so this is invariant. And it turns out that you can show at this order in derivatives, it's the only invariant. So the claim is that the most general action is a generic function of this quantity. Instead of the determinant, we use the square root for technical reasons, but of course, a generic function of the determinant is a generic function of the square root.
So here you're describing your one component
fluid. One component fluid,
okay.
Without conserved charges. There's a generation of this
without
the generation of this with conserved charges. I'll tell you in a second what it is, but I won't use it. Why do we have a generic function here? Turns out that we have a generic function because the equation of state of a fluid can be fairly generic. Okay, so this generic function will be related to the equation of state. And in particular, you can check that you reproduce the correct behavior of hydrodynamics to lowest order in derivatives. So you consider you take the stress energy tensor coming from here, either as the Noether current for translations or by coupling this to a metric. There's a metric here, of course, and there's a square root of g here if you want. You compute the stress energy tensor, you compute the equations of motion. They are identical to hydrodynamics. With these identifications, rho is related to f itself, and p is related to f and its first derivative. And now you see the relation with the equation of state. A given equation of state is an algebraic relation between p and rho, which defines a first order differential equation for f, which you can solve uniquely up to an integration constant, which turns out to be irrelevant, meaning just a matter of normalization. And so a given equation of state gives you a given f, and vice versa. A given f gives you a given equation of state. And u mu, yes?
Yeah, it looks like the equation of state that say that the specific entropy is constant. Is that so it's not
yes.
All possible fluids.
This is, so to lowest order in derivatives, in a fluid, you have a conservation, an exact conservation of entropy. And so in particular, you have, yes, but there's no entropy production to lowest order in derivatives.
No, not entropy production, but that the entropy
per particle. Yes,
so
here we don't have a conserved, here we don't have a conserved.
This is independent of the temperature and the pressure, something like that. So this is,
so,
this is a specific, I mean, not all fluids satisfy that.
So this is, first of all, this is a fluid without a conserved charge for the moment. So you cannot even define what you mean by entropy per constituent. But perhaps what you have in mind is here is the commoving entropy, meaning the entropy density in commoving space is constant.
Yeah.
And that's exactly right. If you don't have dissipative effects, you can change the physical entropy density just only by compressing or dilating the fluid. But you cannot have independent entropy production. You see what I mean? Now, if you include a conserved charge, you'll discover exactly what you're saying, that for a fluid with a conserved charge in to lowest order in derivatives, n over s is constant. So number density over entropy density is constant. But this is true for all fluids with conserved charges to lowest order in derivatives. Okay. And then u mu is a particular, I didn't write down the indices here, but it's a particular contraction with epsilons of derivatives of phi, which you could have guessed directly from geometric considerations. Remember that our phi i's are commoving coordinates. And so by definition, commoving coordinates do not change along the flow. So it means that u mu has to be orthogonal to all these gradients. Okay? So these are three constraints for u mu. One extra constraint comes from normalization. And so you determine u mu uniquely, and it takes exactly this form. Okay? In particular, coming back to your question, this little b that we define here as a geometric quantity turns out to be the entropy density if you apply thermodynamic relations to rho and p. Okay.
Sorry, what is epsilon?
Epsilon is epsilon tensors. Sorry, I have two epsilon tensors. I didn't write down the indices. One epsilon tensor contracts the spacetime indices of the derivatives.
Okay.
The other epsilon tensor contracts the internal indices of the phis.
So could this be a superfluid?
No. Because a superfluid does not have transverse degrees of freedom. So superfluid is much simpler, in fact. The relativistic effective action was found by Sohn, and a superfluid is just a P of X, where X is the d phi square for some scalar, and the scalar is, you should think of the scalar as being expanded about mu t, so mu is the chemical potential, so the scalar is mu t plus perturbations, okay? Whereas in our case, our scalars are expanding about x, like I told you before. No? The equilibrium configuration there corresponds to x. Here, the equilibrium configuration corresponds, you should think of this as a phase, some sort of phase, corresponds to a phase rotating at constant speed, given by the chemical potential. That's the statement.
But I mean, what is the physical reason that you cannot
do it for superfluid? Well, because superfluid, I mean, when we think about, this is my personal viewpoint, okay, so maybe many people in the audience will disagree, but when we think about a superfluid as a special fluid, it's sort of misleading, meaning that from the field theory viewpoint, a superfluid, I would define it, and other people would define it, You define it as a state, in a relativistic superfluid at least, as a state in a relativistic theory which has a non-vanishing expectation value for some charge density, and that charge is also spontaneously broken. You have these two features, finite density for a charge that is spontaneously broken, okay? So for instance, in, let's say, liquid helium, you could say, okay, I have a system with finite helium atom number density, and atom number is spontaneously broken. Spontaneously broken in that case means Bose-Einstein condensation at some level. No? And so these two requirements uniquely tell you what's the effective field theory for the excitations. There are Goldstone bosons in a situation when you have spontaneous breaking. And it turns out that the effective field theory is described by this P of X expanded about this background here.
Why wouldn't there be an equivalent description in your FireEye language?
Well, because you know that to get a superfluid, it's crucial to take into account Bose statistics. Uh-huh. Whereas here, I'm completely neglecting those subtleties. Here I'm saying, for an ordinary fluid, let's say at finite temperature, I'm just trying to do the classical mechanics of this medium. So you're really looking at different regimes for these physical systems. See what I mean?
I mean, you still satisfy energy momentum conservation in Bose's case. I mean, that was, I mean, those symmetries that you were assuming, the SO3 and then translation, the internal symmetries, I think it's still there.
I have very little intuition about the emergence of superfluid dynamics from microscopic considerations, meaning that it's really, to get the correct low energy description of superfluids, it's crucial to take into account the fact that you have identical particles with the exchange symmetry. Whereas here, I'm completely neglecting that in a sense, no? Yes.
Yeah, it looks like you have a three mode here.
Yes.
And why the longitudinal mode, transverse mode should have same velocity?
Zero velocity. Sorry, why the transverse mode should have?
Oh, one mode have a zero velocity.
The transverse modes have zero frequency. It is a divergence, you see. So only the longitudinal guy. So let me say. So if I expand this, the action quadratic order in fluctuations, only the longitudinal guy acquires a gradient energy, which in terms of dispersion relation gives you sound modes and vanishing frequency modes, which you can think of them as the linearized progenitors of the vortices. So a vortex in constant rotation, let's say, is not a propagating wave. It's something that stays there. And if you think about the constant rotation at linear order in the displacement, so from t equals 0 to t equals epsilon, let's say, that looks like free motion. That looks like a zero frequency motion. Okay? So these transverse modes are the progenitors of the vortices. But this picture, this intuitive picture, also tells you that it's a very bad idea in this language to treat the transverse modes in perturbation theory. Because, for instance, in a vortex in constant rotation, nonlinearities enter soon to correct the trajectories of these modes, okay? So the transverse modes are intrinsically nonlinear, even at the classical level, okay? Even at the classical level. And by the way, this is why quantizing this theory is going to be very complicated, because if you try to do it, these are non-perturbative right away. So we tried and we failed miserably. So meaning that there are many subtleties that we haven't solved yet. But this also tells you, on the other hand, that suppose you are able to solve at classical level, to solve the dynamics of these guys non-perturbatively, so non-linearly, then you can still treat sound in perturbation theory. And I'll show you a number of examples later, but I'm running very late with time, so let me move on. So there's a generalization with conserved charges. I don't have time to tell you in detail, but somehow you end up with an action that depends now on two variables, the original B and another variable, which has to do with another field that transforms under the charge in question. And that other variable turns out to be related to the chemical potential. Okay? And so once again, you have an identification between thermodynamic variables or hydrodynamical variables and the field theory variables. And once again, the genericity of F is related to the genericity of the equation of state.
So suddenly S here.
Yes, exactly. So I'm saying on the left-hand side, I have standard thermodynamical slash hydrodynamical quantities.
In the previous case, S was conserved.
So the total entropy is conserved. The entropy density follows this B, which is that funny determinant. So the entropy density changes purely by geometrical factors. If you compress the fluid, you're compressing the entropy density, but nothing
total
else.
Total entropy is conserved.
So we worked out a number of applications, which I don't have time to review in detail. Okay, so both we and other groups have worked out a number of applications. About quantum hydrodynamics, which is what you were referring to. So here we sort of failed, meaning we tried and we isolated a number of problems. I understand Goldberger and Rothstein had made some progress recently, and you're going to publish a paper soon. Okay. We also applied the same ideas to alternative inflationary models. We constructed a model in which inflation is driven by a solid, using the same ideas, because now you have if you want novel actions for scalar fields with symmetries of condensed matter systems, and you can implement them in early universe cosmologies and see whether you gain something by doing that. But anyway.
So when you have one symmetry, how many models do you have? Do you still have one longitudinal model?
Excuse me?
Longitudinal model. When you have one symmetry, how many models do you have?
You have one. Lowest order in derivatives, you have one. We know that a fluid we conserve charge, there's only one propagating mode.
Same as before.
Same as before. If you want, but you have one on top of the transverse modes, which have this crappy omega equals zero dispersion relation, you have another mode with the same omega equals zero relation, dispersion relation. And then you have the sound mode. So in an ordinary fluid with a conserved charge, there is only one sound mode. So what I want to talk about today, in the last 15 minutes, is something I'm working on with these people here. So Steve Gabser, you know. Irvine is an experimentalist at the University of Chicago. Horn and Penko are postdocs at Columbia. And Delacretas is a master student at Ecole Polytechnique in Lausanne. And Lick is my former PhD student. So what are vortex lines and vortex rings? So a vortex line is the only allowed vortex solution is a superfluid. Okay? So in a superfluid, zero temperature superfluid, the compressional sector is the same as standard hydrodynamics, okay? Standard hydrodynamics of ordinary fluids, but the transverse sectors is very different. In an ordinary fluid, you can have arbitrarily soft, if you want, vortices, meaning you can stir water as slow as you want and with as small gradients as you want, okay? Whereas in a superfluid, since in the bulk of the superfluid, the velocity field has to be rotational, vorticity can only be concentrated on defects, okay, where superfluidity breaks down. And these defects, let's say in liquid helium, are really microscopic. They are atomic size, okay, and they are lines. And correspondingly, here I can inject, so in ordinary fluids, I can inject as little energy as I want in a vortex. Whereas here, vortices are gapped. They have a finite mass, a finite energy per unit length. In fact, it's technically log divergent, okay? But let's say in a finite volume, they have a finite energy per unit length.
But at the classical level, I mean, since you have conservation of vorticity, I mean, if you don't have any vorticity to begin with, you will never make them the right hand side either. So
that's right.
So at least classically, they could be equivalent. So.
Well, that's true. I don't have vorticity to begin with, but I won't be able to form these guys either.
Right.
But on the other end, or if you want, they are equivalent in the sense that here, for generic vortical solutions, I form a mess, but I can also be careful and try to come up in ordinary fluids with very thin vortex configurations. I'm going to show a video in a second about this. So people do it also in ordinary fluids. You're right. But I guess what I'm saying is that people are more interested in them in superfluids because in superfluids, as soon as you have some angular momentum, it has to be concentrated in these objects. So they are robust features of superfluids, if you want. Now, they have a very funny dynamical, dynamics. The reason is the following. So, first of all, circulation, by definition, around in any given loop, so let's say I go around once, around the line, is the integral of velocity integrating along the line. And because of this Kelvin's theorem, that's conserved if you neglect dissipation. So it's conserved both in time and also along the line, it's always the same, meaning it doesn't matter which loop you choose to compute it. Okay? So it's an intrinsic property of the line. And you can think of it as the analog of a current flowing in a wire, okay? And velocity, you can think of it as the analog of the magnetic field associated with that current, because the equations of motion, because the equations are really the same. So in the incompressible limit, and for the moment I'm doing incompressible limit, the divergence of V equals zero, curl of V is the vorticity, which is this omega, and this circulation gamma, which I'm defining there, is the surface integral of vorticity, which by Stokes' theorem is also the line integral of velocity. So the equation relating magnetic field and current are identical to the equations relating velocity field and circulation. Okay, so you know the solution for for the velocity field around the line is the Biot-Savart law. Okay, is the Biot-Savart law. Now, why do I stress first of all the equation of motion? Because, so for the moment, this is just the velocity field around the line. But now, if I apply Kelvin's theorem to a tiny loop around the line, I discover that the line itself moves with the average velocity field surrounding the line. So if I extrapolate this velocity field to the line itself, this is the velocity, is the instantaneous velocity of the line itself. So the line moves with a velocity, instantaneous velocity, any line element moves with an instantaneous velocity, which is given by a geometric integral along the line. And if I have many lines with different circulations, that's everything, I just sum over all the lines, so I have integrals over all the lines. This is a first order equation of motion. It tells you that the velocity is given by a geometric integral. It's not a second order equation of motion that defines the acceleration of a line. So it's totally unlike F equal ma, okay? Whereas for ordinary string objects, let's say in empty space, either superstrings or if you throw a shoelace in empty space, they obey standard equations of motion, meaning they really obey Newton's second law. If you push them, they will accelerate with the right acceleration given by locally, given by the infinitesimal force acting on any line element, etc., etc. So why do I stress this? Because there's no room in an equation like this for forces. So at some point, I will compute corrections in equation of motion. I will compute a correction to the potential between vortex lines, let's say. But I don't know where to stick it, the potential, because usually we derive the potential to get a force. But this is not an equation of motion that allows forces, so it's not obvious what to do with it. Okay? Second, there's no free initial condition for the velocity. So if you say something like, I don't know, consider I have a vortex line moving in a superfluid, you're probably already wrong, meaning that it's not up to you to decide the initial velocity of the line. The line decides its velocity based on the geometry and nothing else. And there's another object, which is just an obvious relative of the vortex line, is when you curl up the line in a ring, okay? Now the velocity field goes around the ring in a toroidal fashion, so you should think of this as some sort of smoke ring, for instance, but much cleaner. In a superfluid, it's really atomic size, the size of the defect. And related to this first order equation of motion, there's the statement that a perfectly circular ring with radius r and circulation gamma moves at only one velocity. So if you curl up a vortex line in a ring, the velocity is completely determined, okay? And it's interesting to notice, for what I'm going to say later, that the velocity field away from the ring is going to be the dipole. The velocity field is going to be like the magnetic field of a dipole, once again because of this relation, formal relation between velocity and magnetic field, okay? And the dipole moment is going to be what you expect, the area of the ring times the circulation, times the current, if you want. Another interesting or peculiar feature is the spectrum of excitations. If you take a line and you perturb it, you only have circularly polarized excitations, in the sense that you cannot even take, you cannot take combinations to make linear polarized waves, because there's only one polarization going up and one polarization going down. Okay, these were discovered by Lord Kelvin, so they're called Kelvin waves. And they have a funny dispersion relation. Omega goes like k squared times a log. Despite of these logs in vortex lines, because of these UV divergences close to the line, okay, so A is the UV cutoff that defines the thickness of the line. Later, I'll tell you how to renormalize that away. Okay. And once again, so you have fewer modes than standard two derivative equations of motion, because the equations of motion involve one-time derivative. And notice this annoying log. Not only is it UV divergent, that's perhaps not surprising in field theory. The annoying thing is that it's non-analytic in K. So it's a non-local dispersion relation. You won't get it from a local action, which means that probably you are neglecting some degrees of freedom. Okay? And it's obvious that you are neglecting some degrees of freedom because you are trying to convince yourself that you can describe the line, the dynamics of the line by looking at the shape of the line. But surrounding the line, there is a lot going on. There is this vortical velocity profile, which extends to large distances. So for instance, in this line, it extends, in a straight line, it extends like 1/r. So if you don't take that into account explicitly, if you just look at the shape of the line and how it moves, you are going to see no localities, okay? So I'm going to tell you later how to fix that. So these are experiments. So this guy is doing experiments in a very exotic fluid called water at room temperature and atmospheric pressure, okay, in the University of Chicago. So and these are actual data. These are not simulations. So they have a very fast laser tomographic technique that very high frequency that takes essentially three-dimensional data in real time, so that these videos are completely three-dimensional and you can rotate them in real time however they want. So you see this later. So the first video here so is pushing water through this hole and is sprinkling tiny air bubbles. So the air bubbles flow to the place where pressure is minimum, and it turns out to be exactly the core of the ring. And so you use the air bubbles as tracers. Okay, so you see the ring. So this is a ring. So this is an hydrofoil, and is going to push it. And so you see the shape is sort of irregular. So it will impart some of these Kelvin waves, and you'll see right away that they are not circularly polarized. Even though it looks like you are they are not linearly polarized. Even though it looks like you are starting with a linear polarization, they will evolve in circular way. You see that. And you see the three-dimensionality of the whole thing. Mm-hmm. Now, they are interested in topology. So these are topologically non-trivial configurations. In fact, they were the first ones to be able to knot vortex rings. So this is a vortex ring knotted on itself.
So how do you make them, or how does it make them?
So this is water, and so these hydrofoils, it just has a 3D printer, and he says, look, I don't have a theory, but let me try this shape. So he prints a shape, and he pulls it, and if he's lucky, he's lucky. So this is experimental physics, I think. So
so as you pull the shape out, it kind of, it cuts through itself, but it then heals itself again?
That's why I'm saying they have no real theory on how to form these things. They just know that you have to stir up the fluid and hopefully something will happen. and these are two vortex rings knotted with each other. And there's also other groups doing experiments. And by other groups, I really mean in the taxonomic sense. So these are dolphins. So certain dolphins are known. So this is some YouTube video I found. So dolphins are known. Certain dolphins are known to play. Look at this. So now they eject a vortex ring from the blowhole, and they play with them. But they play so confidently, you see. So he's able to take off smaller pieces. And by the way, and they look much cleaner. They look much cleaner than Irvine's vortex rings, and much more long-lived, no?
Sure.
And and apparently they're also edible. You see.
Do they use the sonar at all?
Yeah, there's various theories. In fact, there's a lot of papers published in I don't know comparative psychology journals about the importance of vortex rings for dogs.
Working on the effectiveness
of dogs. No, but you're kidding. But I got in touch with a guy who's training these dolphins, and I asked him whether they can be trained to do experiments, like scattering experiments. No, the reason being that, you see, so they are much more confident than Irvine in playing with them. And I think it's because they live in water, so they know exactly.
Yeah.
They feel what's going on there. No, we don't have a feel for first order equations of motion, whereas probably they do. So maybe it's much more efficient to train them than to ask Irvine. Anyway, so. Yes. Anyway, but so now in water, okay, you play with these things, but in superfluids they're really important objects, okay? And once again, it's because they are the only objects that can carry vorticity, can carry angular momentum. And also, their gamma is quantized, okay? So it's a much more stable quantity. In fact, you don't have you don't have viscosity at low enough temperature, so these are really conserved quantities. Gamma is a quantum object. And in fact, I find it amazing that so H bar is tiny in human units. The mass of helium atom is tiny in human units. But it turns out that when you take the ratio, it's a totally sensible number. So I mean, you could really see the quantum of vorticity in liquid helium. Millimeters per second. Anyway, and so superfluid turbulence is believed to be a tangled mass of these vortex lines and vortex rings. And I understand there are open questions about the rate at which it decays, because usually in ordinary fluids, turbulence decays by dissipative effects, but in superfluids at low temperatures, there's no dissipation. So one idea is that they decay by emitting phonons, but apparently the rate is too slow. So there's an open question about the decay rate of superfluid turbulence, and maybe our techniques can help shed some light on that. And in pulsars, they are also believed to be very important for the dynamics of the pulsar as a whole. So the statement is that in pulsars, you have neutrons condensing, you have neutrons forming a superfluid and protons forming a superconductor. And in the neutron superfluid, you can have vortex lines. In the proton superconductor, you can have magnetic flux tubes. And there's a lot of them, because there's a lot of angular momentum and a lot of magnetic field. And they just intersect, and they get tangled up, and they interact a lot. But it's not known how they interact, because it's a very difficult problem. And apparently they also pull on the crust, okay? And the claim is that they can break the crust. They can give you earthquakes, if you want. And some people claim that that's responsible for the observed glitches in the spinning down of a pulsar. Okay, so these are speculative theories for the moment, but it would be nice to understand whether we can say something about that. And recently, very recently, they've been observed also in fermions at unitarity. So these are important objects in the dynamics of superfluids. And so we want to understand them. And so once again, our idea is to understand them via effective field theory. So remember, the equation of motion is this. So far, my understanding is that the theoretical approach has been, take the equation of motion, is a mess, because it's an integral differential equation of motion. You have first derivative here, first time derivative equals an integral. Put it on a computer and hope that you get nice results. But of course, there's not much understanding going on if you do like that. So seems to me that, at least for certain questions, you can do better by effective field theory. So first step is write down an action that reproduces this. Now, the action, I mean, one possibility would be take our fluid action and try to reduce it to these very particular configurations. But in fact, it's much faster to start from scratch. Take the degrees of freedom of this line and try to write down an action in the quick way that reproduces this equation of motion. And the responsible way instead would be try to write down all terms allowed by symmetries, organize the derivative expansion, and see that that equation of motion is the only thing that you can get. We did both, and they match. Okay? So let me just give you the quick way. There's a funny kinetic energy. Now, lambda is a parameter along the line, and time is time, of course. So there's a funny kinetic energy with one time derivative, and that's crucial because you want a one derivative equation of motion. And then there's a non-local interaction, so you integrate along the line twice, or along all lines, all pairs of lines that you have, if you have many of them. And it's non-local because you have to reproduce this non-local term on the right-hand side. Now, okay, you are this is kind of a bittersweet result, meaning that, yes, you have an action, but it's non-local, so we don't have intuition about non-local action. So, for instance, we don't know how to count a denominator like this in a derivative expansion. Does it count as one derivative? Can we have other powers? Can we have fractional powers? What's that now? But it's a one over our interaction, so we know exactly what to do. We introduce a vector potential that couples to whatever is at the numerator with an instantaneous gradient energy. Remember, we are doing incompressible for the moment, so it's allowed to have instantaneous propagation, so instantaneous gradient energy. And you know that if you solve the equations of motion for A and you plug back into here, you get exactly this non-local interaction. So this is exactly like magnetic interaction between currents. Once again, the analogy in magnetostatics is really working perfectly. And on the other hand, also notice that A appears at most quadratically. So this equivalence is exact even at the quantum level. In the path integral, this is a Gaussian path integral, and you are not losing anything by just solving classical equations of motion. So this equivalence is exact. And now the analogy with the magnetostatics, as we said, is perfect. So the current corresponds to the vorticity, as we said. magnetic field corresponds to the velocity, and the vector potential of magnetostatics corresponds to this A, which we call the hydrophoton. It plays a role analogous to the photon, but for hydrodynamics. The only difference is that there is no Lorentz force. There's no force at all, in fact. What we said is that, look, the velocity of the line itself is given by the Biot Savart integral. So instead of having a Lorentz force for a given B, that B defines the instantaneous velocity of your object. That's the only difference with magnetostatics. So the dynamics of the magnetic field, if you want, is the same. The dynamics of the currents is different. And then you can go further. Suppose you want to now look at a vortex ring, okay? And suppose you want to look at it from large distances, so you want to write a point particle effective field theory for this guy, okay? You just, in a sense, dimensionally reduce this, okay? You do those integrals. Ah, sorry, this would be the responsible way to get the same effective field theory. Let me not elaborate on that, apart from saying that it's the only action, what I wrote down, that realized the non-linearly, the spontaneously broken Galilean invariance, okay? Galilean invariance is broken twice here, both by the line and by the medium, okay? They both transform nonlinearly under that, and that action nonlinearly realizes that, with the interesting result that you see there's a gamma here and there's a gamma here, and the claim is that these two coefficients have to be the same because of Galilean invariance, and so in particular that equality is protected against quantum corrections, for instance. So the point particle limit of vortex ring gives you a crazy action. So X is the position of the vortex ring, the center of mass, let's say, position. And mu is this R square N dipole moment. And it turns out that the variational principle is such that both X and mu are variables that you have to vary with respect with. And it turns out that they are, you see, they are conjugate of each other. We have mu X dot. And you can have the action both at the level of interacting with this hydrophoton field, or if you integrate out the hydrophoton field, you get a short distance contribution, which corrects the Lagrangian for each vortex line, and in particular, it's responsible for having the vortex ring move forward at constant speed. And then you have a long distance interaction between different dipoles. Okay, so this is the standard dipole-dipole interaction. This is a crazy Lagrangian for a point particle. Crazy in the sense that even the conservation laws, if you now look at Noether's theorem, are crazy. So the total momentum is the sum of dipole moments. So in this system, the sum of dipole moments is conserved. And the angular momentum is equally crazy. And the energy, for instance, does not depend on x dot. You see, x dot appears linearly, so it does not contribute to the Hamiltonian. So the energy is only a function of dipole moments and distances. And so because of these crazy conservation laws, it's very difficult to understand what goes on, for instance, in a scattering experiment. So one funny situation is this, in which you have two vortex rings. Let's say they come parallel. They come from infinity along parallel lines. So there's a transient region in which they get slightly displaced. But when they are far away again, they go back to exactly the same trajectory as before. So there's no scattering angle, and there's not even an offset, okay? And which is unheard of in ordinary particle scatterings, okay? So in general, particle scatterings happens at all.
Measure time delay.
Yeah, good question. I don't think so. At first order, meaning in the dipole approximation, there shouldn't be time delay because at first order, the only displacements are orthogonal. But that's a good question. I should check actually. Yeah, maybe you can. And let me just conclude. Can I have three more minutes?
Yes.
Let me just conclude that interesting things happen when you start coupling these systems to sound. In particular, in the standard way of doing things, which is what I was saying, take this equation of motion and solve it numerically, people didn't know how to introduce sound in the picture. So it was not known before how to couple these systems to sound. In our case, it's pretty simple because when we start with our fluid action, well, first of all, I should say that we have taken the incompressible limit. Every fluid behaves as nearly incompressible if you move slow enough. So incompressibility is not an intrinsic property of a fluid. It's just a statement about some kinematic regime that you're in. So in particular, if you move slow enough, sound waves are difficult to excite, which means that you can introduce a perturbation theory for sound waves, which is going to be organized in powers of typical velocities over speed of sound. Okay? And that's what you can do with our formalism. You take our original action for the fluid, which has these fields, and you expand the field into a volume-preserving part and a compressional part, okay? Which is perfectly well-defined because these fields have a geometric interpretation, so you can really disentangle what's volume-preserving from what's compression, okay? So in particular, volume-preserving means determinant equals 1. And then you expand the action in powers of psi and in powers of the velocity field associated with this guy, once again, because you know that psi will be small, so compression will be small, if the velocity field is small compared to the speed of sound. So you have these two expansions. You expand the action. I won't bore you with the expanded action. And then you look at how the velocity field of the incompressional mode associated for or the compressional field associated, for instance, with the vortex line couples to sound. Now, when I introduced this A, I didn't tell you that the curl of A is in fact the velocity field associated with the incompressional mode, with the incompressional motion. Okay? So wherever now in this expansion you see the incompressional motion velocity field, you can just replace the curl of A. So this is a leading order coupling between the compressional mode sound and this hydrophoton business. And now you can just use it in Feynman diagrams. So for instance, suppose you want to compute the sound emitting in the scattering of two vortex rings. So from the hydrodynamical viewpoint, this is a mess. You have two toroidal velocity profiles approaching each other. They overlap. When they overlap, there's going to be some compression going on there. And you want to understand how much of that compression makes it to infinity. Okay, sounds like a nightmare. Now, in Feynman diagrams, so you have these two vortex rings. I showed you the point particle action they have. They couple to the hydrophoton. They exchange an hydrophoton. The hydrophoton has a trilinear coupling to sound, and it emits a sound wave. You compute it. It's a trivial computation. I'm just showing you the pies just to show you that. I mean, it's a very concrete computation you can do. And you get the power emitted. And it was not known how to do that before our effective field theory techniques. Now, we talked with Irvine about measuring.
What R is?
R is the radius of the ring. Sorry, capital R is the radius of the ring. Little r is the let's say, the impact parameters. Yes, something like that. Okay. So it's tiny. It's suppressed by many things. But on the other hand, I'm not sure exactly how sensitive microphones are, but I'm sure they can be pretty sensitive. So we asked Irvine whether he can measure this. He said, this is difficult.
Infrared divergence?
Excuse me?
Infrared divergence. Is there any risk of soft phonons?
Probably. But to higher orders in perturbation theory, you'll see them, no? Probably. Yeah, probably. But hopefully they will be handled in the usual way, no? I mean, we haven't got it to that yet because we are doing, for the moment, we are just doing lowest order computations.
What's really behind my question is the lowest order representative? That's really what I was wondering.
Sorry.
Is there a way to check that somehow? Is it obvious that this lowest order calculation is the dominant, you know, represents the dominant effect?
Sorry, usually it is, no? Even.
Well, usually, but that's why I was thinking about soft.
Yeah, I know. Good question. Okay. I haven't thought about that. Good question. You're saying maybe if you start resumming the whole phonon emission, you get something
it's
bigger?
It's not a thought I have. Maybe it's, yeah, something like that.
Okay, I haven't thought about that. Yeah, good question. I don't know. Now, more promising to be detected is another situation. So we asked, according to Irvine, who's going to do it, actually, he's going to stick a microphone now using in his tank. So he's saying, okay, I don't want to do scattering because it's too complicated. Let's do an oscillating vortex ring. So I have a vortex ring with some Kelvin wave excitations. And once again, it's a very easy computation, and it's going to emit sound. It's a very easy computation. So the vortex ring is a dipole. The moment you have Kelvin waves excitations, you have an oscillating dipole, okay? That oscillating dipole excites an hydrophoton, and that hydrophoton couples to the sound, okay? So you emit a phonon. Do the computation, and indeed, it's less suppressed, meaning it's as suppressed as before in terms of V over CS, but in terms of ratios of scales, before we had little scale over big scale to the tenth, now we have little scale over big scale square. This little scale A is the amplitude, the physical displacement amplitude of the excitations in the vortex ring. In fact, in the video I showed you before, this was order one, okay? So it's not necessarily that small. So this is potentially measurable. That's the claim by Irvine. So he's gonna check. Unfortunately, I won't have time to give you review of the rest, but we computed another number of things, for instance, the potential mediated by sound between two vortex rings, and is also, Irvine is also confident that maybe in some situations we can check that as well. And also we have a relativistic generalization of the old formalism, which potentially can be applied to neutron stars. We just started this, so I don't know where we're going, but that's an interesting fact. So let me conclude. I think that at least for certain questions, the effective field theory techniques can be useful for hydrodynamical systems. In particular, as usual, they are efficient computational tools whenever you can apply some perturbation theory, let's say a multiple expansion, you have ratios of scales, or generically you have small parameters in your Lagrangian and you want to do perturbation theory. Effective field theory is the ideal framework to do that. And we have applied it to vortex lines and vortex rings, which are very important ingredients in the dynamics of superfluids. And it seems to me that we are making real progress in the sense that not only are we able to compute new things, we are also able to apply field theory techniques to understand these things, which is better than just putting them on a computer and see what comes out. Thank you very much.
Any questions? Itai.
Since you mentioned at the end, is there actually a prediction from computers for all those things that you have predictions from KFT?
No, because they don't know how to, even theoretically, they don't know how to couple to sound. It's not known in the literature before this how to couple those equations to sound.
But is there any computation that you can do on with your tools that you compare to the simulation?
I have to check. That's a good question. Usually they are interested in, you see, here, I mean, as I said, effective theory is useful for perturbation theory. So that's the only, that's the things that you can compute very naturally. Whereas in the literature, you find more complicated problems that they're trying to solve numerically. For instance, there's a phenomenon that when you have boundaries, the vortex lines pin to the can pin to the boundary. So you want to understand then how the vortex line deforms while not moving at the boundary. Those things are very difficult here. So I don't know. We haven't introduced boundaries yet.
Scattering one, you could probably do.
Scattering one, so they're not interested in scattering because maybe it's not a natural question for them. Even here, you see, I mean, this question that I didn't go into, but the fact that you have objects like these lines coupled to a gapless field, which is sound, and now you know that sound can propagate at large distances. So from the field theory viewpoint, it's obvious that it's going to mediate a potential. Whereas in the hydrodynamics literature, I've never found that question anywhere, let alone I've never found the answer to the question. Here, I mean, it's a one-line computation. It's this Feynman diagram. We also did, my student also did the next to leading order for fun. Turned out to be not that fun because it's pretty complicated, but okay. But just as a proof that, a principle that you can really keep going, and you find a potential that goes like 1/r³, etc. So I guess what I'm saying is that the language suggests different questions. And so in particular, the scattering, I couldn't find anywhere where people studied scattering. But yeah, I'm sure they can do it. Yes?
So the sound wave emitted by this
oscillating
vortex is one loop.
Sorry, very good. So these are misleading Feynman diagrams. In the sense that to lowest order, you can really think of this line not being as not being an actual propagating line, but as being two insertions of an external source. So what I'm saying is that there's no propagator here. This line carries no propagators. These are two external sources. So I'm saying the more responsible way of drawing the diagram would be, I have two sources, which are my oscillating dipoles. I have the hydrophoton, and this hydrophoton emits a phonon. And so now there's no propagator, this is a three-level diagram. On the other hand, you're right, meaning that graphically, this is suggestive of the fact that eventually, to compute the diagram, you're going to end up with an integral, when you start taking Fourier transforms, et cetera, that looks very much like a loop integral. So at some level, this is technically as hard as a loop integral,
so,
but it doesn't have the same quantum interpretation,
so
if you want.
How does it depend on ubiquity?
It does not, exactly, yeah, it does not.
I mean, it's literally like a whistle loop.
Why a Wilson loop?
Because the probe is classical.
Ah, because the probe is classical.
Right, so you just integrate over the position.
Yes,
it's not
exactly.
Not integral of A, integral of B. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, but so, yeah, so there's no, there's no divergence
here. Is there a momentum running along the vortex that the sum of it?
No. No, no, no. Exactly. That's what I'm saying.
Just one mode.
Yeah. Well, actually, it turns out the funny thing is that if you have, you can have as many modes as you want, but only the first two contribute to the dipole emission. So all the others decouple somehow in this, in the lowest order. Yes?
So have you worked out MHD? Have you thought about how your effective fluids couple to electromagnetism?
Well, that you can do, but somehow MHD is, at least in some cases, the regime they are interested in there is a regime in which conductivity is very large. And conductivity large, so first of all, fluid dynamics at lowest order in derivatives is equivalent to zero conductivity. So when you have zero conductivity, like you have a perfect insulator, that's a non-dissipative system, meaning you cannot dissipate into diffusion of charges, let's say. Now, it turns out that for them, infinite conductivity is also non-dissipative. So in a sense, you have two inequivalent non-dissipative regimes. One is zero conductivity, and the other is infinite conductivity. Hydrodynamics corresponds to zero conductivity, usually, and you treat conductivity as a small perturbation. It turns out to be a first order, a first derivative correction. So I guess what I'm saying is that I'm still kind of confused about how to apply the same techniques to that other regime. It seems to me that it's a physically different regime that, and you have to think a little harder. But I'm sure you can do it. Yes, I think so. That's the state. Yeah, it won't be this coupled to the electromagnetic field. It will be a modification of this coupled to the electromagnetic field. Yes.
When you were flashing to the conclusion slide, I saw one before it, which mentioned rotons.
Yes.
Did you have anything new to say about rotons?
Well, I have some hope I can tell you about. So here's the statement. So for those of you who don't know what this is, so in liquid helium, the spectrum of elementary excitation looks like this. So as a function of P and the energy, okay? You have the phonons, which have a linear dispersion relation. And then when you go down to atomic sizes, so down to up to very large momenta, which from the viewpoint of our effective field theory are outside the regime of the effective field theory, but the experimentalists don't care. They just measure the excitation. I mean, they just measure the spectral density of excitations at whatever energy you have. And so they find a minimum, okay? And there's a claim, first of all, the existence of these excitations is very funny. So if you are close to the minimum, you can have either sign for the group velocity. So if you have an excitation on the right, it's moving slightly to the right. If you have an excitation to the left of the minimum, it carries momentum in that direction, but velocity in the opposite direction. And this is experimentally verified. So you can have rotons, these are called rotons, these excitations close to the minimum. You can have rotons moving that way, and imparting momentum this way to another particle. Okay, so this is experimentally verified. And also, if you are right at the minimum, the propagation speed is zero. So you have a static roton which carries finite momentum, whatever that means. Okay, and based on an ansatz by Feynman about the wave function of helium atoms, these are thought of as microscopic versions of vortex rings. So it's really like having a few helium atoms moving around in a toroidal fashion, at least that's the claim. Okay? But of course, from the hydrodynamical viewpoint, it's a very shaky claim, meaning that hydrodynamics breaks down at those scales, so it's not obvious even how to check the claim with our effective field theory techniques. There's a nice review by Donnelly in 1997 that says that, in fact, very little is known about these rotons. Experimentally, we know a few properties. Theoretically, we don't know anything, essentially. And so we contacted him like last year asking, okay, has anything evolved since 1997? He said, no. So, I mean, simply people got bored of helium-4, I understand, and so they started looking at something else. But I think that with these techniques, maybe we can at least check whether if approaching the rotons from the side in which effective theory is still valid, and you start computing virtual phonon effects, can you see a sign of the fact that a vortex ring, which is becoming smaller and smaller, at some point is going to have such large quantum effects due to virtual phonons that maybe a minimum like this can develop? This is the hope. And it's not necessarily a computation that is under control, because effective field theory breaks down here. So it's not even obvious how robust the computation is. But I'm just saying, let's try and see what we get. Yes?
Just a comment about it. Many years ago, I spoke with condensed matter theorist at Maryland named Richard Farrell.
Okay.
He's not alive anymore. And his take on the roton was that it was a kind of deformed mode that you would see in a regular lattice at the edge of the Brillouin zone. So if you just deform this picture into what the dispersion relation looks like on a lattice, it just goes like this forever.
I see.
And it's really replicating the same degrees of freedom. But when it comes down on the side here, that's a copy of the origin shifted by the wave vector that identifies modes on a lattice.
Yes.
But so since a liquid is not really regular like a lattice, it has a deformed version of that.
I see.
So he suggested that, and I don't know how deeply he understood that, but that does sound like something that could be susceptible to effective field theory, because it's very, it's much less complicated than microscopic vortex rings.
Well, but still, I mean, if you're going to momenta that probe the edges of the Brillouin zone, you are exiting the low energy effective field theory anyway.
Right, but maybe you just needed, like if you had an exact lattice, of course, there's no problem going all the way to the bottom, because it's really just another copy of the long wavelength modes.
Yes.
So maybe you just need some, I don't know, double field theory, and I don't know how to do it. But it just doesn't seem that complicated, because it's a deformation of something simple.
I see what you mean. Okay. And he didn't have any concrete implementation.
It was completely words.
Okay.
Just his vague. He said, that's how I think of it.
Yes. Okay.
You have to have spontaneous breaking of translational order. Sounds a bit unlikely. I don't know. I mean, there's no other evidence of it.
Why do you say you would have to have that?
Well, to have a lattice picture. It implies spontaneous breaking of translational order, and I think there's no other evidence.
No, but I don't think so. Suppose you took a completely regular lattice, and then you get the standard dispersion relation. And now let's move the atoms around a little bit so it's not quite regular.
You've still broken translation.
Right, but so does the liquid. The atoms are here and not there.
No. The Goldstone boson will be lifted. You won't have any Goldstone boson in that system, because it's spontaneously breaking.
Well, it's lifted. Look at the roton minimum. It's lifted.
Right.
I don't know. But it's not obvious that, but since you're looking at the microscopic structure, the effective theory is not particularly useful. No, you really have to talk about individual displacements of atoms in that model, I think. No. I'm just saying that the fact that you repeat the same structure over and over doesn't mean that the effective field theory is valid throughout. So maybe it's valid close to one minimum, then it's valid close to the other minimum, but in between it breaks down, I'd say.
Right. Yeah, you wouldn't be able to reach
continuously
from there to
there. Well, I guess the question is it more important to use effective field theory or to understand the roton?
To understand, no, I agree. Yeah. I agree. That's the idea. But I guess what I'm saying is that I'm not, maybe that's an interesting idea, but I'm not able to apply my techniques to that idea because they break down like they do break down here. So
right.
You see what I mean?
Unless
you have to come up with new ideas, new techniques, I think. But you're right. I mean, one should, the interesting question is to understand the rotons, not to apply. Yes.
Have they not said what is a stable?
Very good. So it's, so the claim is that yes, so let me correct myself. I'm confused because on the one hand, there are topological conservation laws of topological numbers. So for instance, this, how do you call it? The analog of the magnetic helicity, which is like B dot A or something like this, I think. So there's an analog in hydrodynamics, which really has to do with how many times you knot. Yeah, linking number. On the other hand, if you look at simulations, or even at other videos by Irvine, reconnections are very frequent, and those do break those topological times. So I'm confused.
There's a same thing comes up in MHD.
Okay, very good.
So yes, when they break,
yes.
You lose the conservation of the current whose integral leads to that conservation.
I see.
But it's a very local a process. The breaking.
Yes.
So it's a very small non-conservation of this integral. So to a good approximation, this integral is conserved.
I see.
So I don't know.
That just means it changes in steps. That's what it means.
You mean at the quantum level?
No. I mean, just if you follow the sleeping
number,
it'll be 1, and then it'll be 0, and then...
Presumably this process is dissipated. That's the thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, but you use... I think the claim is that they also see it in superfluids. But maybe you are saying, well, when you actually go to the core, there is dissipation at the core because superfluid is broken there. Maybe you are right. Yeah, so there is conservation. I think the statement is that this is conserved with zero viscosity, but then when you get to the core, viscosity is important. So, so reconnections do break it. But maybe the effect is small, you're saying.
Well, no, actually, so in it's your small, case, velocity is concentrated in defects. And I was thinking about the case where it's spread out over the fluid.
But it's still a topological quantity, you know?
Yeah. So in MHD, it's not concentrated in defects. It's spread out throughout the fluid, and then it's basically conserved. But if it's in a defect and the defect breaks, then you completely change it.
But I think you can also express it as a boundary integral, no? In which case I'm confused now, because if the defect breaks here, why should the boundary integral change? Yeah, I don't know.
Well, you need, to get the conservation law, you need locally at every point the current to be conserved, which it's not. It's at the point where it breaks.
Okay.
Okay. All right, last question.
Yeah, so again about the dissipation. So do you know what the kind of size of dissipative effects are? I mean, like compared to, say, the emission of sound, which you said is pretty small.
Yes, very good. So good point. Yes, so dissipation is probably more important to actually dissipate energy, meaning the amount of energy that goes into sound is less than what goes into dissipation. But this doesn't mean that you cannot, that the sound computation is not reliable. See what I mean?
Not really. I mean, I guess it depends whether they're interacting with each other.
Well, they would be interacting at higher orders because they are both higher derivative corrections somehow, because the couplings between sound and these lines is a derivative coupling. The coupling between, if you want, dissipation and these vortices is also a derivative coupling. So to lowest order in both couplings, you can compute either process, and then the mutual interaction between these two processes would be even higher order, I'd say. See what I mean?
Sorry, what is the dissipation due to if it is not sound?
You're talking about ordinary fluids or superfluids.
Ordinary fluids.
In ordinary fluids, it's just viscosity.
Okay.
Viscosity is there,
but,
and eventually this. But you see, for instance,
proportional to tau.
Proportional to tau. Yes, mean free path. Exactly, proportional mean free path. But I think you're right. Meaning that just as counting derivatives, the sound emission. Sorry, where is it? Sound emission goes like. The power goes like omega, for instance, in this case, omega square. Maybe it's of the same order. Dissipation goes like omega k square. I have to think about it. Maybe it's of the same order. Maybe it's not. I'm pretty sure for ordinary fluids, dissipation, viscosity is more important to slow down these objects than sound. Mm-hmm. But then I'm claiming that the sound computation is still consistent because it's the lowest order contribution to this process.
Yeah.
The coupling I consider is the lowest order contribution to this process. So even if I have other small effects,
I guess I just don't see that there couldn't be, for instance, some dissipation sound interaction that's kind of large relative to these effects.
But I claim that has to be higher order simply by the fact that the combination of two small things is even smaller. No.
I mean, I think maybe what Dan is saying is that if this whole thing dissipated before they interact with each other, then obviously you don't hear anything.
Yes.
Yes.
But
I agree.
It's also true that these vortex rings can persist for a long time.
Yeah, for instance, the dolphin ones, I mean, they live for minutes, you saw them, no? So
well,
it's incredible.
No,
the
that's not true.
Like
I mean, because they were.
The dolphins would actually pump anything.
Yeah, that's right.
No, but not continuously, no? They just form them.
No, but they're on motion of two sound waves.
Excuse me?
They could either use sound waves or they could use their own motion.
In the video, they were using their blowhole.
Yeah,
they would blow air into the.
But that's the formation of the thing. And
no,
then
no,
they just.
No, the dolphins would create it, and then it kind of grows inside.
That's a transient. That's a transient.
Yeah, but then it goes in and it uses its. Nose to
when they bite off smaller pieces, yes.
Off a smaller piece, and presumably if it didn't do that, it would just kind of dissipate. That's
no, but okay.
It's,
anyway,
it's
we can watch the video again. But they live for tens of seconds.
Yeah,
those, no.
Definitely.
Yes. No, I think it's a transient. That's a transient. I think meaning that once again, you're just following air, so it looks like it's growing. But I think the actual vorticity profile is already there, and air is just floating there. I think that's the explanation. But it's a transient, because when you actually look at the longer time propagation, they stay constant in size. It's only a transient.
I've seen that the dolphin putting his melon at the center of the vortex.
And, yes.
While it was growing, was it uncorrelated?
Okay, I think dolphin question.
I have no idea.
Let's see.
Thank you.